today. As a summer of missions to Mars begins, how much do we really know about the Red Planet? Have you ever looked really closely at a photo of Mars? What can you see? It's red, a rust red, and the surface is covered in thousands of holes. Some are tiny, others look enormous.
Craters are places where you can actually see into the subsurface. It's like the history of the planet is laid down, like the pages of a history book. You know, you can look at these sedimentary rocks and trace back what happened in the ancient past.
Sarah Stewart Johnson is a planetary scientist. And in 2004, she became part of a NASA team that sent a rover to Mars. It was called Opportunity. Its mission was to find signs of life that might have existed there thousands of years ago. Each day, Sarah and her colleagues tracked the rover as it made its way across the dusty terrain, going further than any mission before it. And then one day, it stopped.
We had been driving and driving, and actually it's quite funny, the rover like sort of edged right up to the edge of the cliff, and it was an error that clicked off the motion. And so the two wheels were sort of dangling just over the rim.
The rover was lurching over the chasm of Endurance, an 130-metre-wide crater that scientists were excited to explore. As it hung there, Opportunity began sending back pictures to Mission Control.
And those images, they were just projected huge and beautifully all around the darkened room, and it was the most extraordinary sight. These ethereal dunes that had gathered at the very bottom of this crater. It was about the size of a football field. It just held so many secrets, you know. The fact that there had been water there and these sediments that had been laying down in these pools of shallow water that had been underneath the salmon sky all those years ago, and thinking what might have happened, what could have taken place in this site.
The question of what could have taken place on Mars has kept people fascinated for centuries. In the next few weeks, new missions will blast off to try and gather more information about this mysterious planet. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, will we ever find life on Mars? Sarah, what do we know about what it's like to be on Mars?
So Mars, in a sense, is just one giant, relentless red desert. It's a pretty harsh place. It's incredibly cold, negative 60 degrees Celsius. The surface has very little air, less than 1% the atmospheric surface pressure that we have here on Earth. And there's dust everywhere. The dust is so fine. It's got the consistency of red flour or even cigarette smoke. And it's lofted into the air, and that gives the sky its red color.
Take me back to when you first became interested in the Red Planet.
So I think I must have been primed to be interested in these topics. My father was a bit of an amateur astronomer. He would be out in our backyard with binoculars and his astronomy magazine tucked beneath his arm. And during my childhood, there'd be times when I would think, oh, this is just so nerdy, my father. But then I went off to university, and I found that these were the topics that I was completely gravitating toward. And I had this great opportunity when I was a freshman. I was only 18 years old, and I met a professor. His name was Ray Arvidson. He taught at Washington University in St. Louis, and he just let me start doing research in his laboratory, and he took me out to the Mojave Desert, and we were testing prototype rovers for the Spirit and Opportunity rovers that would eventually go to Mars. And it just seemed like the most exciting thing I had ever done.
From where I'm sitting in my bedroom in London, it's quite hard to conceive of Mars being out there. When did humans first begin to understand the planet?
We've known there was something special about Mars. Even the ancients would look up. And of course, there were these five wanderers that moved separately from the rest of the fixed sky. And one of those had this bright color. It was the only one with a distinctive color. And it also had this really bizarre motion where it would sort of move in one direction, you know, against the backdrop of the fixed stars. But then every 2 years or so, it would backpedal and go west against the zodiac for about 60 to 90 days. And then it would resume its motion. And it was from these, you know, very strange motions of Mars that Plato had even concluded that Mars and planets must have free will, for else what else could these retrograde actions be evidence of?
It was an elusive and baffling planet to astronomers for hundreds of years. Through early telescopes, it appeared to be a small red sphere, later estimated to be about half the size of Earth. One of the earliest known representations of the planet, drawn in 1659, indicated markings on the surface. And by the movement of these dark patches across the disk, it was shown that Mars rotated on its axis in a period only a little longer than Earth's.
And so I feel like we've known about this very bizarre sort of point of light in the sky, but it's had this wonderful transformation over the past few centuries, and especially over the last 50 years of robotic exploration into an actual world. You know, just every bit as complex and interesting as our own planet.
How far away is it? How close to Earth is Mars?
So it depends when you ask, of course. Sometimes Earth and Mars are on opposite sides of the sun, where they could be up to 250 million miles away. And sometimes they're much closer together, you know, as close as 35 million miles. And what happens is that every 26 months, the planets align on the same side of the sun, and we have an opportunity to send missions. And we're entering into another one of these very exciting windows. And so later this month, we'll be seeing launches from three different countries sending missions to Mars.
You've talked about how humans have been fascinated by Mars for hundreds of years. Who were some of the people trying to get an early view of the planet?
One was Giovanni Schiaparelli, who was an Italian astronomer. He worked in this observatory in Milan. He had a little refracting telescope, and he went up to the top of the observatory during one of these periods in the late 1800s. And he had this opportunity to observe Mars. And there had been people making Mars maps for a while, but he looked at the best maps that were available, and he just couldn't make any sense of them. They didn't look at all like the planet that he was seeing through his telescope. And he's just started laying down this map of this world, and he populated it with the most beautiful names. And that's why Mars, the surface features, have the most romantic names. He drew from classics and from the Bible and from the Iliad and the Odyssey and all of these wonderful works of literature. He also saw something very peculiar, these linear features, which he used the word canali to describe. In Italian means channel. This word in some ways got lost in translation.
So from that mistranslation came the theory, the idea that there might be actual engineered canals on Mars. Did this become a well-regarded theory in the 19th century?
I think that's absolutely true. There was a period where much of the literate world did believe that life had been discovered on Mars in the form of these engineered canals. But I think the thing to know is that Mars, even with really great big telescopes, it was so hard to see the planet's surface because of the wobbling atmosphere we have here on Earth. And so turbulence and eddies would make it very difficult, you know, for the first half of the 1900s. We just couldn't see Mars any better, you know, and it would take space telescopes and missions to really be able to bring that planet into better focus.
It is a great dream possessed by millions of men on Earth. The dream of reaching out into space to look at another planet. But for some men, reaching out to another planet no longer seems a dream at all. Deep in this huge complex of buildings and computers, a handful of men have spent years striving to make that dream a reality. One single try, as, for the first time in history, men encounter Mars.
And that didn't happen until well into the 20th century. And it wasn't until 1965 that NASA managed to get really close with a mission called Mariner 4. What happened and what did it find?
It was a very simple mission in many ways. You know, it had about the power of a pocket calculator.
The spacecraft is flying toward Mars, about to pass within 6,000 miles of its surface, and then out into space. One pass, a single chance for everything to work.
And it was heading off, and it was just a flyby, you know, it was going to cruise by the surface, not go into orbit or anything complicated like that. And it ended up returning 21 photographs.
240,000 bits of binary code, representing the shading of 40,000 dots that will finally make up the first picture.
Each of those photographs took 8 hours to return to Earth. And there was so much anticipation at Mission Control as these engineers and scientists waited that they even began printing the data on thin strips of paper, and they tacked them up on the wall and began coloring by numbers with a bunch of pastel chalks because they just couldn't wait.
A complex system of computers is required to convert these numbers into pictures. Some workers decide to hand make their own picture of Mars by shading the numbers.
And it was just heralded all over the world. But then we really saw it, you know, when those other images began coming back.
Picture number 11 shows craters 3 to 75 miles across and several thousand feet deep.
They were staggeringly disappointed when they returned images of a cratered surface, you know, much like the lifeless moon.
The picture suggests that Mars has never had an ocean or substantial atmosphere. The Mariner 4 pictures neither demonstrate nor preclude the possible existence of life on Mars.
And the New York Times even declared that Mars was a dead planet after looking at these images.
This must have been so disappointing, not just for scientists who've been theorizing about life on Mars for years, but also for the American public.
Yes, and so this was, of course, a very, you know, heady time in the middle of the Cold War, and there was lots of competition with Russia. And when the rocket had first launched, you know, it was just this moment where it just seemed like we were going to see another world, and it would help us get some perspective from all this strife going on here at Earth. And Lyndon Johnson, you know, took the podium in the East Room of the White House.
I think I speak for every American when I tell you how very proud and how impressed, how grateful we are for
In these really evocative recordings, you can see him kind of lean his head to the side and say, you know, it may just be that we're alone.
It may just be that life as we know it, with its humanity, is more unique than many have thought.
After that setback in 1965 and many other missions, NASA finally managed to land two probes on Mars in 1975 in their search for life on the planet. How did they manage to do it?
So it took a lot of very brilliant human beings working on the technology to make that possible. The Viking 1 and 2 landers launched in the 1970s, and they landed in these two different spots on Mars, and they performed the very first life detection experiments.
The following day, Viking sent back the first color picture. A fine dust, red or yellow-brown, covers the ground. The sky is a light tint of the same color due to the particles of dust suspended in the air.
And this was billed at the time as, you know, the greatest experiment in the history of science.
45 days after these historic events, Viking 2 landed in an area 4,600 miles northwest of Viking 1's landing site. A vast plain, littered too with rocks resembling those on Earth, produced by volcanic processes or by meteorite impact.
But that experiment failed. You know, it was very confusing at the beginning because at first there seemed to be this huge result. And there were even people on the team that were sending out for champagne and cigars.
Camera one's on. we're looking good.
But then it just got very confusing because the result just fell away. And then there were three instruments in total, and they got positive signals for two of the three. And then there was another chemistry instrument that found that there were no organic molecules on the surface in any of those samples. And that was perplexing as could be. Organic molecules are the building blocks of life as we know it. And there were fewer organics than the moon, you know, none detected.
Wow. But, you know, back in the 70s, this idea of life on another planet did seem tantalizingly close to a lot of people. And that was really reflected culturally at the time, wasn't it?
Science fiction writers populated the cities with terrible creatures of heroic size, with skills beyond Earthman's dreams.
You know, probably most famously in David Bowie's 1976 song, Life on Mars.
Who's in the best-selling show? Is there life on Mars?
You know, the first Star Wars film was released in 1977. You know, during this period, were scientists convinced that there was life on another planet? And what do they think that life might look like?
Oh, so there were many different opinions. You know, I think some of the most exciting and imaginative and interesting were the ones that were espoused by Carl Sagan.
I think the one thing which is very likely is that if Mars does have life, it will be a life very different from the sort we have here.
He was arguing that we might need a nightlight on these missions because something might walk by, you know, it might be nocturnal and we'd need to image around. Perhaps we'd see footprints.
If there is life on Mars, then there will be a simply fabulous expansion of the perspective of the biologist. Because all the organisms on the Earth, even though they seem to be different, are fundamentally the same. Their chemistry is all identical. We're all the same on the inside. Now the question is, are Martian organisms the same on the inside as us?
And he had this really interesting theory, this idea that there could be macrobes instead of microbes on the surface of Mars, that actually the conditions might favor the development of very large organisms because those organisms would have a greater volume to surface area ratio. Maybe if you were just very large, if you were, say, like a silicon-based giraffe or something like that, that you would be able to conserve heat and moisture. And so he had these incredibly imaginative ideas kind of based on this thing that isn't, you know, scientifically unfounded. You know, it's a little out there, but it was just so imaginative. And Sagan was so great at communicating with the public.
While we're here on Mars, I think it's important to do a British custom. Certainly tea time. And I wonder if we could have some tea on Mars.
And just saying, you know, we don't know. We've never seen the surface of this planet. We just need to be prepared for anything.
Well, there's no way for us ever to determine the generality of life on Earth except by looking for life elsewhere. And the nearest candidate planet is surely Mars.
After this, from curiosity to perseverance and beyond, what's the future of missions to Mars? When I was doing some reading before speaking to you, Sarah, I noticed that there were a lot of missions to Mars in the 1960s and 70s, but after that they seemed to stop. Why did that happen?
That's right. The last message from Viking, the last radio communication oscillated to Earth in the early 1980s. And once those missions died, there were no Mars missions again until the late 1990s. I think part of that was there was a lot of excitement about other targets in the outer solar system and other missions that could be sent. You know, one good thing that came out of that period was a lot of those planetary scientists, or at least a subset of them, like started turning their focus on our own planet and trying to better understand life and places that were these very extreme environments and how different types of life survive.
You're one of those scientists who has spent some of your career exploring Earth to better understand Mars and have also worked on several missions to the planet. At the beginning of this episode, we talked about your experience on the team that launched the Opportunity rover in 2004. And then in 2012, there was Curiosity, which has gone on to be one of NASA's most successful missions to Mars. What's been your role in it?
Right after the launch of Curiosity, I found out that I was pregnant, which was my very first child, my son, that was actually born just before Curiosity landed. And so I was not out in California where so many of my friends and colleagues were. I had just gotten home from the hospital after having a C-section. But I did watch it, you know, even though it was in the middle of the night, NASA broadcasted it on NASA TV, and there's this amazing landing sequence, the 7 minutes of terror. And many of us were very worried about, you know, is this actually going to work? And we were landing a metric ton on the surface of Mars through this never before used system. But it did. And it was really an amazing moment sort of watching that. I was so fortunate to have a chance to join the mission a few years later. And so I'm still working on that mission today as part of the Sample Analysis on Mars team.
And as you mentioned, Curiosity has been roving on Mars since 2012. What are some of the biggest findings that it's brought back for us? And what has it taught us about Mars?
The goal was to search for signs of habitability. And Curiosity has found those in spades. It touched down in the center of Gale Crater. And in the center of Gale Crater, there's this mountain called Mount Sharp that rises very high and records most of Martian history. And when the rover sat down, touched down into the floor of the crater, it drilled into this ancient mudstone. And the evidence that we found suggests that this was a suite of minerals that had to have formed by the presence of water, but also like pH neutral water, sweet water, the kind of water that you might even have been able to drink if you were standing on the surface billions of years ago. Curiosity's found all the sort of essential ingredients, all the elements that are required for life as we know it. And Curiosity has definitively detected these organic molecules, these building blocks of life.
And as you mentioned earlier, we're now at a point where we are closer to Mars, and we're at a moment where other missions are going to be heading up to the planet. And one of those is Perseverance, which NASA is hoping to launch in the next few weeks. What are they hoping that that rover will find?
Perseverance is kicking off this breathtakingly ambitious campaign to collect surface samples and bring them back to Earth. And so this will require not one, but three missions, you know, and a lot of international partnership to make this happen. But it stands to be this paradigm shift in how we think about traces of life. You know, now we're dealing with data that's coming back from orbiters and landers and rovers, but to actually have these carefully selected samples from Mars in our laboratories that we could just hit with everything we've got, it's really exciting.
Perseverance isn't the only mission going to Mars this summer, though, is it? What are the other ones?
So there's one from the United Arab Emirates, which is their first planetary mission. And it's really quite remarkable because they've only had a space agency for 6 years.
It's very symbolic for an Arab and Muslim country to launch an interplanetary mission. We have taken a step beyond just looking at the skies. We are going there.
It's a little mission called HOPE, which will go into orbit.
If a small young Arab nation is able to reach Mars, truly anything is possible.
And there's also the Chinese Space Agency is going to be spending a trio of probes as part of their mission, Tianwen-1, which means questions to heaven. And that mission will land in the spring.
Sarah, is there any chance, do you think, that we will find intelligent life on Mars?
Oh, well, I think there's very, very little chance of finding intelligent life on the red planet. But even very simple life, microbial life, you know, sort of the smallest breath in the deepest night, I just feel like that has tremendous possibility. You know, most of our biomass is in subsurface of our planet. It's in microbial form. And I think that that's the best chance for extant life on Mars still living today, that we would find it, you know, deep in the subsurface where it's protected from the harsh environment of the surface and protected from the radiation environment. But the thing that gets me most excited is this idea of a separate genesis, a type of life that is completely unlike the life that we have here on Earth. And I just think that would be transformational. All the life here on our planet is basically the same type of life. It's all DNA-based. It's all the same stuff. I mean, if we found life on Mars, it would just the next planet over, it would mean that the universe would be positively teeming with life if we could have a separate genesis just so very close to home.
And how long might it be until humans set foot on the planet? Elon Musk plans to send, he says, 1 million people to Mars by 2050, which feels very ambitious.
You know, it's been so interesting. You know, even since the beginning of the space age, there have been these plans, and they always seem to be about 30 years away of having humans on Mars. I think that the stage is set for rapid progress if we decide we want to do it. But that's not to say that there aren't just immense technological challenges and physiological challenges, just human health and the radiation environment, mental health, all kinds of things that still need to be worked out. It'll be very interesting, you know, like what would precipitate this sort of event? Will it be sort of a concerted international effort? Will it be another space race, perhaps with China? Would it be, you know, the result of private companies entering this domain and disrupting kind of this national space agency framework that we've had? I don't know. I just think that the next few decades are going to be really interesting from that perspective, and I'm eager to see what will happen.
Sarah, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Sarah Stewart Johnson. Do read her book, The Sirens of Mars, Searching for Life on Another World, which is available to buy now from the Guardian Bookshop. Just go to guardianbookshop.com. And if you'd like to listen to more podcasts about space, I really recommend an episode we made last year with the science writer Philip Ball about the new space race, and also an interview Anushka did with the scientist James Lovelock, who was himself part of the Viking mission team and has some interesting views on the prospect of life on Mars. Today's episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.
The search for answers is a goal of planetary exploration, and the journeys of our spacecraft to the near and far reaches of the solar system are beginning to provide some of the answers.